so much for being here. All right, let's get this started. I want to, first of all, I gotta tell you, I blew my voice out yesterday screaming death in Tolkien's Black Speech at 7,000 people. So, true story, so if I start to turn into Edward James Olmos and start going, on this town, it's really important. That's why. All right, let's talk about music and the role that it plays in world building. So my name is Bear McCreary. You guys might know my music. Galactica, Outlander, The Lord of the Rings of Power, as well as a little tiny indie game called God of War, and God of War Ragnarok, and I've done some cool features like Godzilla, King of the Monsters, King of the Rain, and working on all these projects, one of the things that I've learned is that the more diverse the collaboration becomes, the more inspired I get. On Battlestar Galactica, I got to write these 13 notes that ended up working their way into the plot of the final season. And on God of War, not only did I get to co-write and co-produce a song with an artist-composer called Blood Upon the Snow, but I got to act in the game. If you play the game, you're gonna encounter a really cranky dwarf playing hurdy-gurdy in God of War Ragnarok, and that is me. And for Godzilla, King of the Monsters, I got to update my favorite Blue Oyster Cult song, Godzilla, which had never been in a Godzilla movie for 40 years. And I got to work with Serge Tankian from System of a Down, and my favorite metal band, Deathlok. And I got to do this song for Godzilla. So for those projects and more, the narrative world was sort of heightened by what the music is bringing to it. And all of us up here work on a new project called The Singularity. So this is a conceptual rock album. It's also a graphic novel published by Image Comics, and it's a series of live concert experiences. And before we talk about it, let's take a look at something.
Here with me live are the improbable survivors
of the
Jurassic
World. This is so like Jurassic World. That's a great show. My daughter loves it. My friend Zach Stintz is a writer on it. Watch it. Now, let's check out The Singularity.
You didn't choose to live. That choice was made for you. Leaving you to reap the rewards, yes. But also to pay the cost. But you get to decide now. In fact, you must. Because everything that comes next, or doesn't, will be shaped by you.
Like, there's just so much cool stuff happening.
And you have all these beautiful collaborations.
There is an emotional narrative to literally everything that you experience.
So three of the people of the like like 50 or 60 people that collaborated with me to make that are here with us. First, we have Kyle Higgins, who's worked with DC, includes Batman and Gates of Gotham, and Nightwing and Batman Beyond. But the real reason I wanted to work with him is he created his own series of comic books, The Massiverse. He's also a filmmaker and a director. Give it up for Kyle Higgins. Next, we have Matias Becada, a visionary illustrator and comic book artist who made one of my favorite books of the decade so far, Step by Bloody Step. Give it up for Matias. Truly is a singer, songwriter, poet, and composer who has worked with me for many years. Many of you probably heard her voice singing the main title theme to Outlander. Give it up for Ray. That we collaborated, and some of the ways that those were pretty unusual. I want to start with Matias, because for me, visuals are the most like foreign for me, coming from audio. Now you told me your mother was a psychologist and your dad was a musician. How did you end up being a visual artist?
Well, my dad tried to make me both me and my brother musicians, and we kind of not. We did not take music really like with much passion. We loved it, and I love music, and I grew up in a very musical home. But there was also lots of books, comic books at home, art books, etc. So my mom and dad like really encouraged us as kids, me and my brother, to be creative and to pursue all these things. So in my mind, the union between music and other forms of expression or narration is financial. We've been talking about this, but it's kind of like you hear a song you like or a composition you like, and you cannot but help but create images in your mind to go along with it. You're seeing like a movie unfolding in front of you, or sequences or colors or whatever. It comes very naturally for me.
And yeah, I was going to say, it doesn't come naturally to me, it's the other way around. Yeah. Where I'll see your drawings and I start to hear music. And that makes me want to write music. So that's really interesting.
Listening to you, to the tracks that I had to illustrate was obviously super important because of the texture and the rhythm and the general spirit of the tracks, which are usually, you know, epic, generally.
Well, okay, so let's talk about the process, right? That normally you're given script pages and you make a comic book. We have this amazing script by Matt Broom, who we'll talk about in a minute, but you also have this song. And Matias worked on two songs on my record that converted into chapters in the graphic novel, The Singularity. One of them, Rocco's Basilisk, is like this really kind of Matrix-inspired, super dark, post-apocalyptic sci-fi setting. The other one, The Automaton's Heart, is the one I wanted to ask you about, because there are these robot characters that you drew. And in the song that I wrote, I have these sounds of floppy drives. Anybody old enough to remember floppy disk drives from the 90s?
Right.
You can actually program those to play certain pitches. You can turn them into musical instruments. And I'm just curious, when I saw your robots, did the design of the robots in the comic book come from that sound?
Yeah, there was kind of like, I don't know how to say it, sorry for my English, kind of like a machinal, like machinery, repetitive sounds, and yeah, mechanical sounds that go along, that were used rhythmically in the beginning of the song,
yeah.
and goes into a crescendo through the rhythm and stuff. And this robot, these machines in the story are living a very like oppressed existence, doing repetitive tasks, and there is one singular hero who breaks this, or tries to break this this system of oppression. And of course, the sound led naturally the flow and the rhythm of the rest of the story.
That's fantastic. How many times have you had an assignment to make a drawing out of a piece of music?
Actually, this was my first.
Yes. Well, it was amazing, I gotta say, having spent the last 20 years of my life being given visuals and then being told, write music for this. It was pretty awesome to work with somebody such as yourself and write music first and get to you and say, make visuals for this. That was a really exciting experience.
Sure did feel.
So Kyle, I want to ask you about this. you were one of the first people that I called. And I want to talk about your background in film and comic books. I feel like there's so many things that we both grew up on, but in a weird way, we like studied different aspects of it. Like, how did you end up, making your own line of comic books?
Well, I think so much of what we're going to be talking about here today with regards to musical world building, I think there's so much crossover between disciplines, whether it's music, whether it's comics, whether it's film, whether it's starting with visuals and finding music, or starting with music and finding visuals. And ultimately what it really boils down to is telling stories. That's a fundamental component of the human condition. It's something that we all understand, we all relate to, and when it's done well, we learn something about what it means, this whole experience of life, in small ways, sometimes in larger ways. And I think that's ultimately why, I mean, we've been friends here. We met at Comic-Con.
Here, at Comic-Con.
In 2009. This is one of my best friends for over a decade, truly.
This guy caught me out on the floor.
Yeah.
And he had a DVD in his hand of his student thesis film.
Yeah.
And he was like, you can be a McCreary? And I was like, yes.
I was a little more subdued, but sure.
he was pretty subdued. But he puts his DVD in my hand, and I think that night, Rhea and I were here, and we were like, let's watch this. It looked really cool, this gritty superhero thing, and yeah, it was really good.
Well, and I remember when we were emailing about it, actually, Rhea, you thought the score in it was probably all needle drops, meaning like pre-existing music. And at the end, you realize that it was this composer, Joe Clark, who's one of my oldest friends and collaborators. We still work together. We were nominated.
Give it up. These guys were Eisner nominees just last night. So give it up.
But Joe wrote an original. The movie is about a superhero labor union in 1960s Chicago. So the score is done as a kind of a bebop score. And Joe wrote the whole thing. We were like 21, 22 years old. He wrote the whole thing and recorded it in Chicago at DePaul. And the thing about it and how I'm moving this all back together is like, it's why I loved Bear's music for as many years as I have. There is a storytelling component to every single thing he does. And it's rare, I don't want to throw any other composers under the bus or anything.
No, go for it.
But you know, every one of those themes that you love in Bear's work, that's pretty uncommon in modern film scoring. It's a throwback in some ways while also being incredibly contemporary to be writing musical themes. I mean, I could not be more proud of you and the explosion you've had with Rings of Power, because I feel like finally, I mean, you were already huge before this, but so many more people have now been exposed to this, your melodies, your leitmotifs, your themes. And so when you called me about this, that was kind of the first thing we talked about, which was you're doing your version of a creator-owned comic book, and you wanted to try to push the boundaries of what storytelling could mean, not only on an album, but from a narrative experience standpoint. And so then I've written a lot of comic books for a lot of years. I wrote at Marvel and DC for a long time. I ran the Power Rangers line at Boom Studios for the first 3 years. I built out that entire universe. Now, I have my own company called Black Market Narrative. We're a creative collective studio, and we run a line of comics at Image Comics called the Massiveverse, which is our own creator-owned superhero universe. But we really pride ourselves on kind of pushing the boundaries of the medium. So like, literally yesterday, we announced that one of our books called No One, which is a true crime superhero series, it's made up of a comic book and an in-universe podcast with Rachel Lee Cook and Patton Oswalt, Todd Stashwick, Yuri Lowenthal, voicing characters from the book. And it's about the characters in the book who are making the podcast as well, in this kind of Batman-esque world. The story has gone back and forth between those two formats for the last year. Yesterday, we announced at a panel one room over that the story is actually continuing in a true crime found footage superhero feature film that I'm directing. And the film is in universe with the comic and the podcast, while also being, it's an adaptation as well as a continuation. So when Bear was like, I want to do a comic book tied to an album, it's like, yes.
Yeah, you were the first and only call that I made after I had made this collection of demos. And one of the voices on those demos was Rhea Yarmo. So I want to ask you, Rhea. You've obviously been a huge part of my life and my creative life and have been an integral part in making so many of the things that I think so many of these people out here adore hearing. And yet, I think also narrative, I hear narrative in your music as well. And one of the things you've always talked about is how your dad was a professional musician and your mom was a professional screenwriter. Which episode of Star Trek TNG did you know?
Star Trek TNG Night Terrors.
Night Terrors. Anybody remember Night Terrors? Right. So, did that influence, did those two influences come together for your sort of creative life that you're shaping now?
Yeah. I mean, although they might seem kind of disparate, like my dad a guitar playing, a singer, songwriter, my mom a screenwriter, they were both, as you know, to your point, they are both telling stories all the time. I mean, as a screenwriter, you're creating an entire world. You're populating that world with the people who you get to know, who you get to describe, who you get to see from the inside out. And my father made it his business to tell stories, largely stories about perhaps women he'd known in his past, for better and for worse, shocking list of those, but all very fascinating. And so I was kind of surrounded by that in my life, just kind of a soup of character creation and like human situation exploration. So I was sort of doomed to be an artist. Like there wasn't going to be a career as an accountant for me, no matter how stable it might have been. So what was your question?
That was my question. So my next question is, for a lot of the people that worked on Singularity, I wrote a lot of lyrics with my brother Brendan McCreary, who you saw in that video. But for a few people that really wanted to roll up their sleeves, they contributed as lyricists writing the material that they were singing, and you wrote the lyrics to Antica Thera Mechanism.
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask what it was like working as a lyricist specifically on The Singularity.
So it's interesting because most of the time, you know, with my own work, I'm doing the music and the lyrics. It's rare that I'm only doing one part, although in our collaborations over the years, I mean, we've collaborated a lot, but it's funny, it's usually been me contributing my talents to something you've already made, and with this, it was like really a collab, unlike we've done before. And so it was more like, I was thinking, what perspective do you have on an ancient submerged machine? Like, how are we gonna write about that? And it's like, there's been documentaries on it, so I wouldn't really be adding anything to the mythology of this piece of technology by simply describing it. So I thought,
Do you want to, just in case there's one person here who doesn't know what the Antica Thera Mechanism is,
well, listen,
don't have to raise your hand, it's okay. We'll explain what it is.
Would anyone like to tell the class? No, basically it's this ancient collection of gears and cogs that is, you know, very rusted and very encrusted, you know, a couple thousand years older, I don't exactly know that. But it was like 82 fragments found near, I think, Athens or something, right? And no one knew what it was. It was just technology that was ancient and no one really understood. They found out that it was some sort of an ancient, like, calendar, like a very complex one, predicting stellar events.
It's the oldest known computer.
Yeah, basically, yeah. So anyway, totally a fascinating object, and I thought, how am I gonna talk about it? Well, I'm gonna be this object, because it has found a way to harness all this knowledge that human beings have been trying to use to predict the future, to understand the past, yet it's been isolated. It's been separated. So what is the psychology of this thing, you know? And so I kind of wrote from the inside of the mechanism out, talking about its observations over the years. And it was really interesting to fit that into, what is it, like five groups of stanzas or something?
I gave you a really weird song form with no chorus.
Yes.
And we had Kim Thayil from Soundgarden, like Black Hole Sun, playing guitar on it. And I had this great track, but it's an odd piece. But when you said it as the voice of the machine, quite literally behind the glass where it is now, and the children are coming up, and you're talking to them. I found it just so moving. I would have never thought to do that in a billion years. So, bravo, first of all.
You gave me some good music.
Thank you. Matthias, I want to ask you, there's so much emotion in your work when I think about the books that you've done and the pages we've done together. How do you go about communicating emotion in what, to me, it just blows my mind when they pencil lines and make me feel something?
Well, I try to always maintain some level of clarity when trying to transmit emotion. With music, I think it's kind of easier because it's a very universal language. When you hear something, you can realize it's a sad sound, an epic sound, something that it's meant to evoke certain sensations happens immediately when you hear it. With images, it's different. If you overload or maybe choose to put too much detail or something like that in a drawing or a comic book page, you might end up like muddying the message, muddying the emotion you're trying to transmit. So clarity is important. I've learned a lot from animation in that sense. I love animation. I'm a comic book artist, but I'm kind of half animator, amateur animator. I've been working in animation.
Well, there's so much motion.
Yes.
And Matt Broom, our writer, was excited that you were working on the chapter that you wrote, The Automaton's Heart, because he had envisioned a single page where we watch this robot leap, you guys actually saw it in the trailer, across all these tracks and gears, and it was very animated. It looked like a storyboard. And I was like, how is that going to work? And he goes, trust me, Matthias can do it.
People do that with me all the time. They just drop very difficult challenges.
You did an entire graphic novel without words.
Yeah.
Seriously, you did a 190-page book where there are no words in the entire book.
And there are no symbols either, because like arrows or things like that, nothing.
That means that just to like, I'm going to just accentuate it. The level of clarity in visual storytelling has to be so high. The craft level that requires for you, for all of us as readers, to look at an image and understand what we're supposed to be taking in, to understand where your eye is supposed to go, to understand, to flow through the page, where the page turn reveals are for maximum effects. Like, it's such a high level of craft to do something like that when you're not relying on speech bubbles or word balloons or sound effects. It's a remarkable feat. If you didn't win the Eisner for that, you absolutely should have.
We weren't even nominated.
Well,
there you go.
But I think clarity is important.
Clarity is a fantastic word. I was doing an animated film called Positive Fury, but it was working with Rob Minkoff, who directed The Lion King, the original animated one. And he said something that I'll never forget, where he said, animation is like a haiku. You say the absolute minimum, maximum clarity. And one of the things that I've struggled with in an inspiring way, making the singularity, is going from writing a score where I have just a gigantic canvas to writing a song, which really should be, like I think a good image, as absolutely ruthlessly efficient as possible and short as possible. And I found that, like, that's another thing we struggle with in structuring the graphic novel itself, where I have now 25 songs. How do we turn that into a story? The clarity of message, like thinking about what do we want the listener, the reader, to get out of this? The person who's not up on this panel that should be is the writer, Matt Broom. But you brought in Matt.
Yeah.
So talk a minute about, I had an idea and I said, let's turn my set of demos into a story. I have what feels like a concept album, but I want it to be narrative, and I have one requirement. I don't want it to be an anthology. As much as I love Heavy Metal 1981, which is a lot, I don't want to do that. I want one story, but I have singers swapping in and out. I've got Sarah Tonkin and Rufus Wainwright and Corey Taylor, and I have female singers, and I have rappers. How do we tell a story with a single protagonist that the voice changes, and you called Matt? Why?
Well, Matt is one of my closest collaborators. We met when I was doing Power Rangers. Matt is one of those, he's one of the single best writers I've ever been around. He's one of those types of thinkers and world builders where when he presents you an idea, it's so fully formed, and it's an incredibly thoughtful at kind of each step of its formation. I knew that something like this, while being incredibly outside the box, would also be very much in his wheelhouse. And so, like, fundamentally, stories are about change. They're about change by way of conflict. Characters overcoming a conflict, failing because of a conflict, pushing up against that conflict. You could hear it in all of the musical tracks. That applies to...
I think music is tension. Exactly. And release. It's the exact same thing in a slightly different language.
When you hear the opening section of the Singularity, da 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 da, and then as you hear that little motif develop over the course of this album, how it weaves in and out, how it develops, how it changes, how it mutates, I know Matt responds to that, because that's a journey, that's an arc right there.
Yeah.
And where Matt is incredibly smart, and this is one of many reasons why I love him, we all pride ourselves when we work on a project in taking full advantage of the concepts, in playing to the strengths of the medium that we're working in. In this case, when you're talking about an album and you're talking about multiple songwriters, you're talking about multiple styles, multiple genres, it's also called the Singularity. Matt is the one who unlocks the idea that this could be a story about the death of a multiverse. And marrying form with function, the idea of songs and a track order and different artists, well, what if we mirrored that in the narrative storytelling component as well? So when you're talking about the death of the multiverse, you're also talking about reincarnation. So we are actually working with 15 different artists on this book, and we crafted the story, Matt crafted the story, that really helped, it played, the concept worked with the form in such a really married way that it made sense that you're watching this character not only reincarnate through these different lives, but face challenge and conflict after conflict, literally resulting in the death of worlds at every turn, which feels incredibly, well, I can't swear, incredibly freaking metal. Like,
yes, yes. And yet that he found beauty in it. And one of the most beautiful tracks, Rhea, is actually yours. And one of the things that I thought was interesting is in the early gestation of the record, I almost worried that that your song might not fit, you know, in between extreme metal songs and all these hard rock anthems. And yet, over and over, people single out your track. And I wanted to ask about your sense of where, like, how important that kind of beauty is in music versus the tension that you need in order to tell a story. Because there's something, I think your voice is very beautiful, but I find that the song is like, I find it, I'm like, it's very tense to me as you're waiting to figure out what's up with the Antikythera mechanism. What was that like to you?
Well, I think lots of times beauty is what you find in between mystery and denouement, you know? Before you know where things are going, there's limbo, there's kind of like the ground dropped out beneath you, and either things are going to be beautiful or things are going to be terrible.
Yeah.
And that, within that moment, it's fearsome and it's freedom. And I think the freedom is where we feel that sense of beauty. It's kind of like, it's facing the unknown, and I don't know, how am I supposed to describe this? It's almost like making a wish, like you make a wish for how you hope things are going to be, and no matter how things turn out, the hope for that is beautiful. And that's why I think you can find beauty in things that are very dark and very challenging.
I mean, I couldn't say it any better myself. I find art beautiful even when it's not. I mean, one of the chapters you did, Matthias, Rocco's Basilisk, is an extreme metal song that I wrote, and I reached out to Jens Kidman from Meshuggah. Anybody knows this band? This guy's got a voice, okay? I mean, he sounds like a demon. And yeah, I remember when I got his first vocal back, I listened to the tracks he sent, and I started crying. because it was so brutal. But I loved it, but I was like, this is so, it's so emotional. And then Matthias, when I saw your artwork, this our protagonist wakes up in this sort of animal-like body that's plugged into, God, I don't know, how would you describe it?
It's like a very complex biomachinery, completely hostile and violent. That was what I was trying.
It's like in The Matrix when people were kept in those tubes, but with a big body horror element, and that you're not necessarily in one piece while you're being kept alive.
It's torture.
Yeah, but that's Jens's voice, and that's that song, and but it all came together, and it was just bigger than anything I could have done on my own, which I thought was really, really cool. And that was sort of like just a microcosm of the entire project, which was creating something so much bigger than I could have ever imagined. When I set out to do it, I just originally wanted to write some songs that I would have fun playing live. And then it just got bigger and bigger, and you know, really culminated in today, getting to be at a signing at Image Comics. I was on the table next to Todd McFarlane, and I was like, dude, I'm here signing my own graphic novel next to this guy who's inspired me since I was a kid.
Let me ask you, how, if at all, how did the development of the narrative affect your development of the music?
It affected it in a few big ways. And I created this list of songs first, and I, with my brother Brendan, we put the songs through their paces. They are haikus. Even the songs are 10 minutes long. That's as short as that song can be. But then Matt came up with these ideas. And he came up with these three protagonists that are identified by the color of their eyes. Blue eyes, yellow eyes, red eyes. And the mystery of the story is who they are to each other. Well, I wanted to represent the story directly on the record. So after the songs were done, I worked with Matt to craft three monologues that show up in the book, but also show up on the record, and I got three of my favorite actors to read them. So you talk about collaboration, now I'm suddenly voice directing Ryan Hurst as Red Eyes. This is my favorite voice actor from God of War Ragnarok, who's the only guy that could stand up to Christopher Judge. He played Thor in that game. I worked with Lee Pace from Foundation and the Hobbit trilogy. Lee is amazing! And Lee stepped up to the plate and was so psyched to play Blue Eyes, the protagonist, and Danai Gurira from Walking Dead and Avengers and Black Panther. And all of them, they performed these monologues, and then almost more like a nod to my original job, I then scored their monologues. But it is my hope, right, that when people listen to this record and suddenly you hear Lee Pace start doing this incredible monologue, that you realize that there is a broader story there. And that's really a gift, I think, from Matt and you guys cracking the code, and singers like Rhea bringing this incredible beauty, and artists like Matthias bringing this visual clarity to the story. And it's just become so much bigger than anything I could have imagined.
Let me spin it back on you then as well. So you've worked on a lot of established franchises, stories, worlds, some incredible stuff that everyone in this room knows. What is it about creating something new that speaks to you? What is it about that, not only the process, but the finished piece that, and what different muscles does that stretch for you?
For me, it was about being generative instead of reactive. For 20 years, people have been bringing me stories, and I've been real lucky, you guys. I get to work on some incredible, incredible things. People ask me, is it scary working on Lord of the Rings? I'm like, no, I'm not working on Lord of the Rings. Okay, I'm excited. But that blank page, what do I want to say as an artist? That was terrifying. It was so terrifying that it was building up in me for years that I had to do this. I didn't do this record because I wanted to. I did it because I had to do it. And the first day that I started writing, which was now 5 years ago this summer, I remember I sat down at the computer and I put away God of War Ragnarok, which I was working on at the time. And I go, I'm going to write a song for my own record today. And then I got sick. I got dizzy. I thought I was going to throw up. I mean, I literally stepped back and thought, oh, I had food poisoning. And then I realized it was my body that was telling me, like, no, you can't do that. You're supposed to be scoring this other project. You should just do that. And I powered through it. And then I realized, nope, I want to do this as well. And so it was a result of something that was been building up in me, you know, for a long time. And then I just found so much joy in it that I wanted to then, it was like almost like an excuse to reach out to my friends. I called Sarah Stonky, I called you, I eventually called people I didn't know, like Rufus Wainwright and Slash. And there was this like, it became this like whirlwind of positivity in my life. Because then everybody who was friends with me immediately wanted to help. And then people that didn't even know me would listen to a track and they would say, yeah, I'll do it.
And see, to me, that's the best kind of world. Because it's world building that's coming out of clearly a singular vision, but ultimately it's a collaboration. And, you know, we live in an era right now, you know, I've worked on a lot of, I love Batman. I guarantee no one in this room hates Batman. At a certain point, you can only consume so much Batman. You know, I feel like I'm good on Batman. I've written a lot of Batman. I'm good on Batman. Everything that you love, every story that you love, every world that you love, every video game, every movie, every TV show, at some point, no matter how many iterations of those characters that there have been, at some point, they did not exist. And the importance and the significance of building new things and taking chances and trying to push the boundaries of what storytelling can be, and in my case, in your case, that means all of our cases, across mediums.
Yeah.
To me, that's the best, most exciting, interesting type of world building that we can do in this day and age.
I couldn't agree more. And for anybody out there that's creative in any way, raise your hand if there's a creative aspect to your life. If you're an artist or a musician, you write. Okay. What I want to make sure that you guys get out of this is that if you're ever stuck or you're uninspired or you feel like you maybe reached the end, the extent to what your current skill set can do, as far as it can take you, collaborating with people that do something you don't do and seeing where that takes you is the best way to shake things up.
Yeah.
I mean, it almost like find people you like to work with and then just do something, but let the collaboration of your, the combination of your skills be what determines what you actually do. If someone's a painter and someone's an artist and someone's a dancer, I don't know where that leads. But I know it leads somewhere interesting.
I'll do a book of that.
Let's do it.
I'm down for that.
I mean, this has been really the motto of my life for the last 5 or 7 years. I've been working on really a couple of projects that nobody knows about. I've been working on The Singularity. And I mean, I even ended up working on a stage musical. I've been writing what I hope to be a Broadway show about particle physics. Who would want to see that? So I've actually been working with an incredible team to adapt a documentary directed by Mark Levinson called Particle Fever about the discovery of the Higgs boson, the God particle, at the Large Hadron Collider. Now, if anything is like right to be a big epic musical, I think it's that. And I've been so lucky to collaborate with people that are so much more accomplished than me and know so much more about musical theater than me. My book writer is David Henry Wong, who's a Tony winner, Pulitzer Prize nominee, and he wrote In Butterfly and Yellowface. And my co-writer, co-lyricist is Zoe Sarnak, who's got like a billion shows opening up this year. Our director is Lee Silverman, who is Tony nominated this year for Suffs. I mean, you look at that crew and it's like, it's this incredible coalition of musical theater talent and then me. I actually don't think we've announced that yet. But there it is.
Collaboration.
On that end, musical theater takes a long time, but if they don't have socials up yet, they probably will very soon because I just announced the show. Do check it out. It has changed my life. I've spent the last 5 years writing like 100 songs between my record and the musical theater show, and it's just changed the way I approach everything, and it's been awesome. We are running a little short on time. I want to open it up to questions, if anybody's got any questions. Otherwise, we can keep rambling. Come on up.
I was hoping you were going to stand up, because your outfit looks so good.
Yeah, so same we all.
That's a little old school.
So we all.
So same we all. Can you talk about the live performance aspect? Are we going to look forward to seeing some live
performance? Yes. The three Singularity are the graphic novel, the album, which is everywhere now, available on the vinyl. Signed copies are booth 616. I have a live concert experience. We did one show in Los Angeles. We did a little acoustic show at Amoeba. But there will be more, so follow me on socials. The whole purpose of doing this is because I want to get out and experience it live with people. Yes, great question. Yeah.
Hey, everyone. So I'd like to open up this question to all four of you. If you could take everything that you've experienced, learned, and done in your careers, if you could go back in time to when you first started, what is one thing that you would tell yourself that you know now that you wish you knew then?
Just finish things. Seriously. Like, your taste is why you want to do what I feel like you're probably alluding to wanting to do, which is creating things, and it doesn't matter the medium or form. Your taste is why you want to do it. Your taste is also your greatest enemy, because it means that every step of trying to build the thing, you are judging yourself. Because like when I'm sitting down to write, I know what good writing is, and this shit ain't it. But ultimately, you have to just respect the process. And the process is that it sucks until it doesn't suck. And the only way you get better is by finishing things. That's unfortunately the truth. And the longer you wait to try to go do the perfect thing or take the perfect swing, the longer you're gonna spend not actually growing.
That's great. What about you, Rhea?
I would say don't let anybody else tell you who you are.
Yes.
Sometimes people who have your best interests at heart, they will think about their own lives and they'll think about, well, I wish I had done that, so I think you should do that. But it doesn't always work that way. So you have to trust yourself. And if you fail, it's not failure, it's a step.
Wow.
You know? So.
Matias, what about you?
Any advice? It's in line with what's been said already. Have fun and try to do things with honesty and directly, because it shows. People experience what you do, can very easily see when something is done with heart, with passion, with fun, with pain, with whatever it is, but it pours through the work of art, whatever it is. And if you fake it, or you're not sure, or you're like double checking every step you make, it will show as well. And it doesn't take a very like educated person in art to tell. Anyone can tell if you were having fun when you were doing something, and anyone can enjoy more or less a piece of art according to the sort of connection you had with it. So just have fun and try to connect directly with what you want to do, directly.
I don't have anything else to add, that's all great advice.
And the only other thing, as artists, I know you all know this, but seriously, you guys leave impacts with your work, and seriously, thank you all for being you and for doing this.
Thank you so much.
Hi. This is Ashley Prepare.
All right.
Okay, so I first heard your name with Battlestar Galactica, and I was like, what did you guys name?
Thank you.
But in that show, and of course also in some other of your shows, you've incorporated original IP songs. So going through all that, and I love the original Godzilla being incorporated into, you know. But with Rings of Power, you're not really expanding, or like, Howard Shore wrote Masterpiece. So what have you tried to take, and what have you tried to be completely original on with some of the things in those stories?
That's a great question. I always love incorporating old material, and I've had access to classic material in every permutation you can imagine, where I can have free reign, do whatever I want. I am completely hands off. I can use some of it. And so first of all, you know, there is a part of it that's out of my control. I always advocate to be able to have access to material that I want to hear as a fan. In the case of Rings of Power, I just did not have that access. In the case of Sarah Connor Chronicles, I had extremely limited access. But sometimes I find that is actually a blessing. Where I then am forced to create new thematic material. And the truth is, with Rings of Power, it takes place so long before the Peter Jackson trilogy. There is no Shire, the Hobbits, or even the Hobbits. there are these nomadic Harfoots. There's a handful of themes, like sure, it would have been awesome to be able to use, but at the end of the day, I feel like I'm creating a body of work that will stand on its own and then lead into Howard's work for all the people like me, looking forward to binge watching the entire show and then binge watching the director's cut extended edition.
A quick follow-up, since Howard Shore did the opening thing?
Yes.
Same thing for season two, or is there a new?
We are keeping that season two theme, of course. Howard's music is amazing.
Okay. Hello. Thank you guys so much for being here. I just had a quick question. As artists, I know that we deal with, you know, down days or blocks. How do you overcome that, like when you're writing or drawing or?
I'll tell you. So some of y'all know I have a child.
Two childs.
And I found that after having child one, I was like, somehow I have less time. But I was like, well, I'm not gonna stop creating and making music. So what I realized was, while I used to have the leisure to kind of, you know, sit back and let the muse arrive when she will, I no longer had that leisure. And I said, okay, my daughter is in preschool from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. This is my workspace. So I didn't go home. I sat in the lounge at preschool and I said, work. And I just started putting notes. I started writing notes. And I started just doing it. And I started writing words and the notes. And the more I just made myself do it, the more easily and reliably it showed up.
That kind of discipline is exactly the key.
Yeah, so
you just set aside, I'm gonna be creative in this window, and even if it's all crap, it will exist. It's kind of what you were saying about just getting something finished.
I was gonna say, my mom is a painter, and I'm actually collaborating with her right now. She's painting my poetry, and I'm writing music to the poetry, and then we're gonna have a big art show. I'll let y'all know, it'll happen in about a year. But the way she says is, you throw paint on the canvas, just throw it on, and then you have started, and then there's something.
Yeah, I've tied my self-worth to my productivity, which is obviously very, very healthy. That other question about what I could go back and, you know. I think that I'm very much of two minds with it. I very much agree with this, and I think you, and as I said before, you have to finish things. At the same time, I do think sometimes you can find yourself in a situation where you're also being incredibly hard on yourself if you're not finishing things. And I think it's really important to find a way, whether it's through friends or family, to step back and make sure that you're not being overly hard on yourself in that way, if that makes sense. You know, like, you need to give yourself grace to find the material, but you don't want to be lazy. There's a really fine line there, and it's really tricky. I've never heard that before, but I love that. Like, creating boundaries of time, or whatever boundary you want to, you know, set aside, like just working during that period, that's the discipline is something that there's no fill-in for, you know, button seat time. Like, you gotta put in the work. Now, when you're putting in the work and how much of that work you're putting in a day, that can vary and that can change, but you gotta be putting in the work.
Can I say one more thing about this?
Yeah.
Just really quick. I used to kind of judge myself based on how many hours I could put in, and I came to realize that doesn't matter. It's the quality of what you do, not necessarily how much time. If you're working on a song and you come up with one dynamite line, that's a good day of work.
There's a comic book writer who I love who told me once when I was starting out, he's like, yeah, I basically just, I started writing 4 pages a day. He's like, because 2 pages is like really easy. By the time you get to 2 pages, then you realize like, oh, I'm halfway done. And then you can just finish the other two. If you're doing 4 pages a day, by the end of a 5-day week, you have a full comic book script. So when you start breaking it down into those really bite-sized, more manageable, actionable tasks, pretty soon you look up and you realize you've done more than you realized.
Great question, thank you.
Thank you. Also, I'm a huge fan, and I listen to God of War. Just honored over and over and over.
Hello, this is a question for Bear. Out of all the franchises, movies, and TV shows that you composed for, what is your favorite of all of them, and what is your favorite song from that?
Oh, wow! I am so fortunate. I've been able to do so many incredible things. You're asking me today, I am so fortunate to work on The Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power, and I've gotten to write so many incredible pieces for it. With that said, I didn't grow up watching the original Battlestar Galactica. I missed it by a couple of years. But the impact that Battlestar Galactica, the 2003 one, had on my life can never be replicated. Okay, nobody's life has changed as much as my life changed when I was 24 and I became the composer of Battlestar Galactica. So for me, being able to do that, it just has this place tattooed on my heart.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Hi, guys.
Oh my gosh.
How old are you guys? How old are
eight,
you?
8 and 7.
8 and 7, whoa.
I love your Godzilla song.
Godzilla, right on. Godzilla! Whoa! I love it.
My name is Sebastian. And my question is for Bam McCurdy. Out of all the songs you've wrote, which one is your favorite one?
So, truthfully, I gotta say, getting to do the Godzilla song was pretty awesome. And I wanna tell you guys a story, okay? So they hired me to do the score, to write the music in the background while the monsters are fighting. They did not tell me to do a song for the end credits, but I secretly did it. I called Serge Tonkin from System of a Down, and I was like, you know that Blue Oyster Cult song? And he was like, yeah. You want to sing it? And I called in my friends from Death Clock, and I got Gene Hoagland on drums, and we recorded it, a demo of it. But I didn't tell the showrunners, I didn't tell the studio. And we kept getting together and looking at scenes from the movie. So when Ghidorah and Godzilla are fighting, I would play my music in a sort of rough form, and they would tell me what they think. They like it, they not. And then eventually the score was done. But on the last day, I showed them the last scene, and then everybody started to get up, and there were execs there from Legendary Warner Brothers and the director. They started to leave, and I go, actually, guys, hold on. I'm sorry, there's one thing I forgot to tell you. I want to play you one other thing. Just take a listen. And they were like, there were no scenes left in the movie, and they sat down, and I hit spacebar, and the playhead started playing, and the director of the film, we had never spoken about doing this, he looked at me, and he goes, Blue Oyster Cult? And then you heard, and it's so fun. So to me, and needless to say, everybody liked it. It ended up in the movie. But I also, it might be my favorite because I wasn't supposed to do it, and I just didn't. So you guys rock. Thank you so much.
Everyone, when you're in the creative process, and have you ever come across a situation where you're like, oh no, this already exists, or it's way too close to something that already exists, and how do you go about keeping the same vibe?
I'll tell you what scares me the most. When I come across, when I've written something that exists, I usually figure it out. When I write something and I go, hang on, this is good, I usually play for somebody and I go, what is this? It must be something else. I couldn't have written this. And when that happens a few times, and people go, I don't know, what is it? And I'm like, why don't you tell me? I think I just wrote it. Is that around you guys?
Sure.
Usually it's more like, hey, I dig this. Why does this feel so easy? Oh, I'm ripping off myself. it happens from time to time. I mean, but the Prestige and the Bad Magician movie, what was it? You all know what I'm talking about. No, that's the good one. The Illusionist. The Prestige and The Illusionist came out the same year. Like, what are the odds of, it happens from time to time. Ultimately, I think, it depends on how similar it is and what the specifics are. If you're talking about, general concepts or, I'm not going to give examples, but
it's
way less of a problem than you think
of. One of the other ways I do it is I just wear my influences on my sleeves, right? Yeah. So I did a Netflix show called Masters of the Universe: Revolution and Revelation, and I'm it's so obviously Basil Poledouris's Conan the Barbarian meets early Metallica. That's what it is, right? And I'm just like, I wanted to know what that sounded like, so I kind of wrote that. So I just like, you know, in some cases when my inspiration is just something sort of so obvious, I just like to just say that's what it is.
This one time in high school, I was playing my friend's piano. I was so happy I'd written this new song. And she walked in the room and she was like, "Oh, I didn't know you could play Eleanor Rigby."
I think that there's no problem in something you do resembling other things, because that's how we all create our own work. None of us came from nothing. We all choose our very few favorite things. We make it ours, like we absorb things, and we cannot possibly absorb everything. So you choose exactly what you like, the very few things that you have already seen in life, in art, in whatever, and then that will come through you. So if it shows, it doesn't really matter. It's not a bad thing.
It's a good question artists all grapple with. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Last question, here we go.
I have to be quick. So, question for Bear. I'm kind of at the beginning of my composing journey, and I've noticed. Thank you. I've noticed working with directors and getting notes and things like that. It's sometimes hard to really stay inspired and not kind of like lose the joy. And I was wondering if you have any advice for not like treating it like a job and staying passionate.
That is the most important thing. So, one of the things that you need to do is to make sure that you can remain the partner that they need. They need somebody whose whole world is making their story work. They don't know. They don't know that when they ask you to rewrite an entire sequence overnight, you have that tomorrow, and it's like, I'm not even gonna sleep, and then it'll be terrible. They don't know these things. So first of all, do not hold that against them, right? It's very easy to get upset. One of the things that I've done for me, and I would recommend you do, is you build a team that can support you. So I have my team is at Sparks and Shadows. Some of you guys might have even seen this credit appearing on Percy Jackson, on Halo, on Foundation. This is my support team, and I lean on them, because sometimes a score does need to be rewritten overnight. And when a filmmaker says that to me, I can very honestly and openly say, sure, you know what, we should rewrite that, because I'm not the one staying up all night. Right? My team is, but my filmmaker needs that enthusiasm. They need me to be there for them, not to worry about myself. So get the support that you need to give them the answer that they need. Thank you so much, everybody.